Good morning, Oregon, and thank you once again for loading me down and queuing me up. I'm Finn J.D. John, bringing you another daily episode of the Offbeat Oregon History Podcast, which every weekday brings you another story from the archives of the Offbeat Oregon History syndicated newspaper column. Full details of that are at offbeatoregon.com. Do check it out when you get a minute, but first, sit back and relax. Let me tell you the story of the shipwrecked schooner crew, the luckiest shipwrecked schooner crew that I know, rescued by a railroad train. You would think that railroad trains and shipwrecked vessels wouldn't get together very much. This is the only occasion that I know of in which they actually did. The story was first published in the newspapers on May 15th, 2011. Here we go. One stormy morning off the North Oregon coast, probably for the first and only time in history, the entire crew of a shipwrecked schooner was rescued with a railroad train. Here's the full story. At a little after 8 a.m. on January 13, 1912, the four-masted schooner Admiral was on a broad reach through heavy seas. The usual southwest wind was at her back and was gusting with gale force. The ship was headed for her home port of Gray's Harbor. Captain Joseph Bender was having breakfast with his wife and their four-year-old son when he heard a terrified yell from the lookout. "Breakers ahead!" Bender, a seasoned mariner, was not one to linger over eggs and bacon when an alarm like that has been sounded. He leaped to his feet and sprinted for the forecastle. The ship was supposed to be 60 miles off the coast, but of course she wasn't. The southwest wind quarters toward the shore, and as sailors know well, it's easy to fall off the wind when on a broad reach, especially if the wind shifts a little bit. The Admiral had apparently done so, and was now headed straight for a jagged line of rocks reaching out from the mouth of the Columbia River, the almost completed South Jetty. Well, the helm was already hard over, and ironically, if the lookout had spotted the breakers 100 feet earlier, the ship probably would have cleared the jetty by a whisker and been tacking for the open sea. But that's not what happened. There was a railroad trestle running along the top of the jetty for the railroad that was being used to build and maintain it. And this is what the Admiral fetched up on, striking, by an incredible piece of luck, the only spot in the line in which the rocky riprap had yet to be filled in around it. The 683-ton ship smashed into the standing bents, that is, upright posts or piles, of the trestle, and snapped them off, and then impaled itself on their stumps. The railroad ties, along with the spikes and other hardware, flew everywhere. Luckily, no one was hit by any of that stuff. The steel rails hanging out in space started tearing the rigging away, and the whole time, the heavy seas and 70-mile-an-hour winds were thrashing the ship around. Then a massive wave picked the ship up off the posts and jammed it, stern first, into the gap in the jetty. Meanwhile, in a small construction shack not far away, the members of the jetty work crew were getting ready for another day. They had just decided the weather was too heavy to work on the jetty when the telephone rang. It was Oscar Wickland from the Point Adams Life Station on the south side of the mouth of the Columbia. The Cape D, that's Cape Disappointment, life station in the Washington side, had picked up a wireless signal from a steamship sailing for the bar, which reported that a foremaster was in trouble on the jetty. Well, as luck would have it, an hour or so earlier, jetty foreman and future Astoria mayor J.C. Tenbrook had asked an engineer named O'Neill to build up steam in engine number 4, a tiny little 042 construction engine about the size of a small Class C motorhome. They hadn't planned to work on the jetty, but they had some work to do in the yard. 042, by the way, refers to the wheel configuration on one of these old steam locomotives. 0 small leading wheels, 4 large drive wheels, and 2 small trailing wheels. Well, by the time Wickland got there, everything was ready to go. And just a few minutes later, this little engine was out of the yard and on its way out onto the jetty with the 4 of them in the cabin. It was Casey Jones versus Davy Jones. The seas were huge. As they pounded the jetty below, they threw huge arcs of foamy spray up over the little engine, whose hot boiler turned them into clouds of steam, making it even harder to see. The tracks trembled with each impact, and Wickland and the crew, Tenbrook, O'Neill, and engineer Al Seifert, knew that a very large sailing ship had crashed into the line somewhere ahead. So they were moving slowly, hoping for the best, knowing it would be pretty easy to fall into the sea and die. Then O'Neill gave a sudden shout and Seifert cut the power. There on the tracks in front of them was a man, kneeling on the railroad ties, clutching something large under his coat. It was First Mate Andy Anderson of the Admiral, shaking violently and hypothermic nearly to the point of no return. holding the captain's 4-year-old son under his coat. Anderson, unable to continue walking, may have been preparing to use the last of his fading body heat to keep the toddler alive in hopes that someone might find him. Instead, he found himself with the boy in the warm, crowded cabin of a tiny locomotive, which got more crowded when the crew pulled cautiously forward and rescued the other 3 shivering people huddled near the broken end of the tracks, Captain Bender, his wife, and the ship's cook. But the others had clambered off the doomed ship on the opposite side of the gap in the line. Now they were stuck there, 200 feet away, unreachable. No problem. Wickland, the professional rescuer, had a plan. If the survivors on the other side of the broken jetty could keep from freezing to death long enough for him to put it into effect. So Seifert put the little engine in reverse and puffed back along the tracks, more quickly now since he knew the tracks behind him were good, to the construction shack. Wickland's life station crew was waiting for them. Quickly, they unloaded the shipwrecked 5, bundling them into the warm shack. Then they worked with furious haste to hook up 2 flat cars in front of the engine. On the flat cars, the rescuers loaded a Lyle gun, short-barreled cannon made to shoot lifelines instead of cannonballs, and a breeches buoy, which is essentially a sling that hangs from a zip line. The Lyle gun easily reached the other side with its line. The breeches buoy was quickly prepared, and in short order the remaining 7 sailors got their turn to be crammed into the warm cab on their way to safety. Not one crew member died. Yet, not one had a ghost of a chance of surviving without the help that came from that most unlikely of rescuers, the railroad train. I would also note that not one of them had a ghost of a chance of surviving this wreck if their ship hadn't just happened to get stuffed into the one spot in that jetty that was capable of receiving it and holding it fast while they all climbed off onto the rocks. It was an amazing and miraculous chain of events. Oddly enough, the entire time the railroad and rescue people had seen no trace of the Admiral. The seas had eventually forced it through the gap in the jetty and, badly damaged, it wallowed around in the mouth of the Columbia, drifting toward Peacock Spit. There was an attempt to salvage it, which almost ended in tragedy, when, just after a salvage crew boarded the hulk, it capsized, throwing all 3 into the sea. Eventually, it fetched up on Peacock Spit, and the sea pummeled it into pieces like so many other vessels before and since. Well, that's it for today's story, and if you're listening for the first time and want some more information about Offbeat Oregon history, you can get everything at our central website at offbeatoregon.com. You'll find the complete catalog of about 202 columns going back to 2008, plus links out to audio and text feeds on RSS and iTunes, and also to the Facebook page and Twitter feed. The website is also where you'll find full citations to sources for this story, which for today's episode include works by Don Marshall, James A. Gibbs Jr., and Dick Wagner. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band, atlasstringband.com, written by Carmen Ficarra. Coming to Corvallis, drop me a line. Let's grab a cup of coffee and talk history. I'm at finn@offbeatoregon.com, or if you do Twitter, @offbeatoregon. This podcast is covered under a Creative Commons license. For details of that, see offbeatoregon.com/cc. And that's it for today. Join me tomorrow morning, and I'll read you an article from 2009 about the Boston Mills Flour Mill in Shedd, Oregon, which proudly showcases a title transfer deed signed and witnessed by a young fellow named Bert Hoover. Bert eventually brought that flour mill a whole lot of business by using it to help feed the entire world, basically, during and after World War I. Look for that after about 6 o'clock tomorrow morning. And in the meantime, go out and fill up the rest of the day with good stuff. Bye now.